So I want to begin by saying that, you know, one of the fundamental aspects of this path to awakening that the Buddha taught was at least it can be conceptualized as refining our relationship to our moment-to-moment experience. So, for example, if you just kind of think back on the meditation that we did, in one sense, what we were doing was refining our relationship, for example, to our breath. A relationship where we're simply being with it, right? We're simply being with the abdomen rising and falling. And then if something else arises, refining that relationship so we're simply being with it. So if joy arises, can we simply be with that? If sorrow arises, instead of pushing it away or grasping onto it or checking out, spacing out, we're simply being with it. So it's this refinement of our relationship to moment-to-moment experience. And I'm sure you've seen how, just in our lives, how our relationship to what's going on inside of us can really make the difference. It can create our suffering when we're really trying to resist or not really being with our experience. And it can also, oppositely, lead to freedom. You know, a small taste of freedom that some of you might have had is have you noticed how powerful it can be just to see a thought is just a thought? And nothing more than that, right? How powerful that can be, especially with thinking, because that's one of those things that we tend to believe more than we should. And it comes through this refinement of our relationship to thinking. So tonight what I'd like to explore with you is our relationship to something else, and that's our relationship to time. And my main intention in sharing these ideas with you is just to encourage you to really investigate what is your relationship to time. I found that investigating that for myself has made a huge difference, especially in my daily practice, kind of in my practice off retreat. I came to see that for me to really bring this practice into my daily life, I had to examine how I was relating to time. And what I want to point out through this is that I think what you'll see is just like when we refine our relationship to our momentary experience, it leads to this greater sense of freedom. And in the same way, I think when we refine our relationship to time, it can also lead to this path that leads towards awakening. Actually, I also want to point out it's kind of a broader context, not just the sitting meditation in this practice, but so much of our lives has to do with our relationship to time. So much of what drives us, right, is we have these lives that are impermanent, and that's going to be marked by time. So how do we relate to that? Another question that's going to arise in this talk also is that I think really fits in this concept of, or this topic of how we relate to time is how do we envision a life that is complete and whole? What's your sense of your life? What does it mean to live a life that's fully complete? What does that mean for you? Does it mean living until we're 90 years old? Is that what a complete life is? Is a life that ends at 25, is that incomplete? So what is that? What is a complete life for you? And I'll come back to that. Where I'd like to begin is how we conceptualize time, because I think we can get a very clear sense of our relationship to something if we have a sense of how we conceptualize it. Right? So for example, you know, take maybe sadness. If sadness is something I really don't like, then that's going to speak a lot to what kind of relationship I have to sadness. It's one of not wanting it to be there, pushing it away. Or if I have a relationship to sadness that is more that I'm always identified with sadness, there might be kind of a groveling or grasping at sadness. So how I see sadness is a real indication of what kind of relationship I have to it. So how do we conceptualize time? What is that thing? I think the common conceptualization of time is that it's a commodity, right? Just think of the words that we use around time. We save time. We spend time. We waste it. We can invest time. We can take time. It's a commodity. Often, you might have noticed there's a feeling of not having enough of it, of wanting more of it. Do you hear how in this conceptualization there's this grasping? An endless grasping. And you might have noticed this in your relationship to time. Oh, I feel so busy. My schedule's so full. If only I had more time. I need to take time for this. Would you stop wasting time on that? So it's a commodity. And when it's a commodity, what does it breed? It breeds this quality of busyness. And you might notice, have you noticed how busyness can have this addictive quality to it? Again, this endless grasping. That we can get hooked onto being busy. I thought of beginning my talk tonight by saying, "Hi, I'm Brian. I'm addicted to time. I'm addicted to busyness." Because it has that quality. Because when we slow down, have you noticed sometimes what can happen when you slow down? When you're not busy? Sometimes what we're left with is a feeling of hollowness, of incompleteness. Not always, but sometimes. And sometimes the society that we live in really perpetuates that. We come to value ourselves and value other people because of what they do with their time. And as a result, we get lost in busyness. So this is something that this is one of the qualities that of the relationship of it's the, one of the qualities that you can find in our relationship to time that you might be able to relate to. You know, it's a commodity. It's a relationship where we're ruled by and we're at the mercy, literally, of the movement of the hands on a clock or the numbers on our watch. I don't know how many of you read the book Gulliver's Travels, you know, Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. I don't know if you remember when Gulliver was with the Lilliputians. And they come upon his watch, and they're so fascinated with it. They don't know what it is. And I want to share with you their description of Gulliver's watch. So this is what they say about it. They say, "We conjecture it is either some unknown animal or the god that he worships. But we are more inclined to the latter opinion because he assured us that he seldom did anything without consulting it. He called it his oracle and said it pointed out the time for every action of his life." So not only is it a commodity, it's a deity and a rather oppressive one. So I'm not here to necessarily dissuade you from worshiping deities, but just to wisely choose them. So again, here is our conception of time. It's a commodity. It's something that rules over us. Some kind of deity. The Amerindian Indians of the High Andes actually have a different concept of time. So if you were to ask one of the Amerindian Indians about the future, they would point behind them. The future is something behind us. It's kind of interesting. When you think about it, this makes sense because the future for them, the future, you can't see the future. I can't see anything that's behind me. So for them, the future lies behind them. And the past lies in front of them. So if they're talking about the past, they talk about it in terms of it lying in front of them. Because we can see the past. It's happened. And as a result of this conceptualization, they don't obsessively conjecture about the future because it's just something you can't see. So this is a very different relationship to time. So a little bit more about our concept of time, how we relate to time. So not only does time get conceptualized as this commodity or this deity, but it's also quantified, right? 24 hours in a day, 60 minutes in an hour, 60 seconds in a minute. For example, I want to share with you the definition of a second. What is this thing that rules our life? So here's the definition of a second. Some of you might know this. I didn't know about this. So a second is now defined as the duration of 9,192,631,770 periods of the radiation corresponding to the transition between the two hyperfine levels of the ground state of the cesium-133 atom. I wish I could explain it to you, but I can't. It's the movements of an unstable cesium atom. I'm sure this definition has its uses, but it has nothing to do with my lived experience. It has nothing to do with your lived and intimate experience of each moment. It's really important. They're actually two different things. I mean, it is true that you know, they say we have this biological clock in our bodies that roughly follows this rhythm of about 24 hours to 24 hours and 30 minutes. It's really there. But when you think about our perception and our sense of time, it isn't that, right? I'm sure some of you, especially when you've meditated, have had a different experience of time. How a few minutes can feel like an hour. Or an hour feeling like a few minutes. If you think about it, 3 months to live. If you have 3 months to live, that can feel longer than a whole lifetime. Time can feel rushed or it can feel spacious. It can feel endless or brief. So it's important to see that our direct inner sense of time is more fluid, it's more deep than what's on our wrists. So what I want to propose is that this direct inner sense of time and getting more and more of this sense, this direct inner sense of time, is the key to our liberation, is sensing more and more deeply into that. When we really set aside all of these conceptualizations about time, at least not believing in them the way that we usually do, and instead directly witnessing this very moment, where we're sensing that deeper rhythm that I'm talking about. So I'm not saying that we should run away or, you know, forget about the time on our watches, but not to get lost in it, to have a relationship to other rhythms in our lives. So for example, we can be aware of the rhythm of our mind wandering, of it wandering and then coming back. The rhythm of a sound coming and going. The rhythm of the abdomen rising and falling as we breathe in and out. Witnessing feelings coming and going, sensations coming and going. When we really begin to deeply touch these kinds of rhythms, then a wisdom can arise. I want to re-emphasize what an important thing this is to investigate. One of our most fundamental struggles of being human is our struggle with time. You think about your struggles, a lot of times it's going to be that way, feeling like you don't have enough time. The loss of time, the loss of someone, the loss of your own life. It's all wrapped up in time, our relationship to time. I also want to point out that deeply experiencing these deeper rhythms, this inner sense of time, it's different than studying kind of the different theories about time. You know, different theories about time that arise from mathematics, from physics, and things like that. I think that's quite a popular arena now in Buddhism, is looking at like quantum mechanics and Buddhism. But that's an intellectual process, and I'm not talking about an intellectual process. I'm talking about more of a deeper sense of feeling into our experience. So I want to talk about what kind of wisdom arises from relating to time differently or sensing into these deeper rhythms. I think one thing that begins when I sense into these deeper rhythms is I begin to see that each moment is just as significant as every other moment. It's really important to see. Have you noticed that that's not the way we live our lives so much of the time? We value some moments over other moments. We have this feeling that this is the way my life should be, so this is what I'm going to concentrate on. And I'm not going to concentrate on this. I'm going to concentrate on that event I need to go to tomorrow night. I'm not going to really concentrate on opening up my door or closing it or the feeling of a breeze. I'm going to be concentrating on that meeting or that thing I need to get to. And then there's these gaps of time that don't have any significance. It's because we have this idea of what's important and what's not important in our day unfolding. And do you notice when we have that kind of relationship to time, how much, if we're not seeing each moment as just as significant as every other moment, how much we miss out on? And how, when it's that way, when we don't have that value of one moment is just as important as another moment, that time starts to become oppressive. Because then it's, for example, that meeting that's so important and all the time in between isn't as significant, and we somehow need to wade through it to get to that significant time. Yet when we sense deeply into our experience, I think this is what can arise. It's interesting, in the history of Buddhism, time has not been written about a lot. There was one Zen master by the name of Dogen from the 13th century, and he actually did write extensively about it. And it's quite funny. Nowadays, especially with in kind of the realm of philosophy, he's become kind of a darling of those who study postmodern philosophy. So you'll see a lot of books out there about Heidegger and Dogen. So now he's been put into this philosophical realm, which I think is really unfortunate in one sense, because I think what he's really speaking about is our practice, this path of becoming free from being oppressed by time. So I want to share with you just a couple sentences that gives you a different sense of his view of time. So So in one of his essays, which is called Uji, which means time being, like for the time being, he has a statement. He says, time is not separate from you, and as you are present, time does not go away. So Dogen's pointed out that when we deeply witness these rhythms, we experience time as being something that's not separate from us. It's not separate from our momentary experience. If it's not separate from our momentary experience, it's no longer a commodity. We no longer have to worry about spending our time or wasting our time or taking our time or investing our time. Because it's not outside us. We don't have to worry about it going away. In this view of time, all of time is happening right now. All of time is happening right now. It's a different view of time. If we can really come to not only intellectually understand it, but the sense of that, then what can really drop is this letting go of this endless grasping towards time. That all of time is happening right now. You know, another way of seeing what happens when we make time into a commodity is it's actually we're making it into a fixed, constant thing. Right? We're creating a fixed sense of time, something that comes and goes away. Same way that we create a fixed sense of self. We have an idea about ourselves, and when we have an idea about ourselves, it confines us. The same thing about time. If time is something that is some concept, that it's going to be confining. And it's quite interesting. You know, we have time. We have these seconds and minutes and hours and days. And even all the concepts that they use about time still don't work very well, right? Maybe some of you know this. Have you ever heard of leap seconds? So our time isn't so exact. And every so often, they need to add a second or two to time. So there'll be an announcement. There will be an announcement, and they'll say, so on such and such day, we're going to be adding a second. Don't ask me why. And of course, it has many researchers upset, because there's this inexact quality to any sort of time. And of course, Einstein was showing that too, how time changes. If you go faster, closer to the speed of light, then time will change. Or if you're closer or farther away to a gravitational body, then time is going to change. So even that is fluid. And yet we fix it. The same way we try to fix a self. And what arises from that? Suffering. This confinement. And this is different than what Dogen is saying. This kind of time he's talking about, that all of time is happening right now. That it's not separate from us. I want to go a little bit deeper with this. You know, when we deeply witness these rhythms that I was talking about, getting this deep inner sense of time, we can let go of another dynamic that limits our lives. It's this dynamic of racing against really some cesium-133 atom. Racing against that in order to live a full and complete life. Again, I'm asking this question, what is it to live a full and complete life? And for many of us, you might have experienced this dynamic of racing against that cesium atom in order to live a full and complete life. And really, what's fueling that? It's usually what's fueling that is this feeling that something's missing from this moment. That this moment is incomplete. Have you noticed that? if your life was going to end right now, would it feel complete or incomplete? And we can even engage in meditation with this desire, right? We come to meditation in order to fix ourselves, in order to feel complete. We want to try to make ourselves feel complete. Because there's this underlying notion that something's not right here. Something's missing right now. Maybe if I do meditation, I'll find that missing piece. I'll be whole again, or I'll get to experience that wholeness. Because it's not here right now. Have you ever noticed that? Yeah. That's just imbued with this fixed sense of time that I'm talking about. Time is a commodity. I think when we really intimately contact what's going on in this moment, we experience something different, though. As Dogen puts it, he says, each moment is all being. It's the entirety of beingness. You can see why they compare it to Heidegger. Right now, each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. So when we really sense into what's going on right now, what we can get a sense of is that this moment is whole. That nothing is left out right now. And when we come to sense that more and more deeply, there's a sense of freedom that can come from that, right? And I'm sure you can just imagine this freedom. What would it be like to live and to move and to act in this world to notice that this moment right now is whole? Rather than moving and acting that this moment is incomplete and you need to complete it. Do you get a feel of that? So I want to talk a little bit about just some practicalities about our relationship to time. So I want to reiterate, essentially, and then I'm going to talk about some other things. Essentially, it's doing this practice, especially of meditation, of really sensing into what's going on right now. A different rhythm, not the rhythm that's on a clock or a watch. Sensing that more and more, because it gives us the opportunity to sense into, I think, what Dogen's pointing to. A sense of completeness, of wholeness. Not I am whole or I am complete. This moment is whole. This moment is complete. But I think there's some other things that I found really important in my relationship to time that I want to share with you. One is don't be so busy. We use that word so often, right? Well, you must be busy these days. Been busy? What's it like to really put an intention into having a life where we're trying to have less and not more? There was a writer Lin Yu Tong, he was a translator and he also wrote a lot. And he said, besides the noble art of getting things done, there's the noble art of leaving things undone. And it truly is an art to leave things undone, to actually make space in our lives. And it takes effort. It just doesn't happen on its own. So I've noticed now that's one of my practices, to see if I can create space and leave it that way. Really have it that way so that it doesn't get filled up. Because then I could look at my calendar and say, oh, I'm open right now. That doesn't work, right? And then I get busy again. Have you ever noticed that? Maybe you can relate to that. Maybe you get addicted to busyness like I do. But I want to emphasize, it's not just going to happen. It's not just about, now I can relax when this is over. I hear this so often. Well, this project's going to be over pretty soon, and then I can relax. Yeah, right. And then what happens is then your calendar gets filled up. So it has to be this really clear intention. Less, not more. There's wasn't thinking of sharing this, but in the early part of the 20th century, there was this furniture designer by the name of Francis Jourdan. Actually, he began as a painter and studied with some of the French masters, Toulouse-Lautrec. And he said, one can furnish a room very luxuriously by taking out furniture rather than putting it in. Mm-hmm. So that's your job, is to take out the furniture in the house. Yeah. And then there are those times in our lives where we're just busy. There's a lot going on. And what I find is so important to remember that being busy and a lot going on, it's just a thought. It's nothing more than that. And when I can see it's just a thought, then I can really be here right now with whatever's arising. Whether it's opening up a door, it's taking the next step, the next breath. It's important to remember that, not believing that. And also what comes with that, though, is a lot of times underneath that busyness, there's a sensation or there's this quality of worry. And what's important is to begin to be with that, because that's really what motivates us or fuels that busyness, is some feeling underneath that. And what's it like to really hang out with that, to give that time to be with that, the sensations of that? Because what you might find, again, is there might be this sense, it might feel like it's a sense of hollowness or incompleteness. And usually what's happened is there's sensations and a feeling, and then there's the thought of, oh, something's wrong with me, or something's missing, or something's incomplete. But it's important to notice that that's a thought, and the rest is feeling or sensation. And that's all it is. It's just a thought that got connected to some feeling or sensation. Because if we don't see that clearly, then that's going to fuel that busyness. So I want to go back to this question that I began with, of what's a full and complete life for you? What is that? What does it mean to live a full and complete life? Is it the length of your life? Is it what you've done with your life? Is that what you value in your life, is what you've done with it? Or how long you've lived? Or the experiences that you've accumulated? What makes it full and complete? So I want to share with you a poem by the Zen poet Ryokan, which I think speaks to this. He's asking this question. He says, my legacy, what will it be? Right? It's the question we're asking. My legacy, what will it be? Flowers in spring, the cuckoo in summer, and the crimson maples of autumn. Do you hear in that poem what's not there? What's not there is also very striking to me. Ryokan isn't there. He doesn't talk about being a poet or being Ryokan or what he did with his life. He's not even speaking about himself. What is he pointing to here? Flowers in spring, the cuckoo in summer, and the crimson maples of autumn. Is that? It's really to be intimate with our moment-to-moment experience. And what a gift. And it's so striking to me that that's his legacy, to leave that behind. What would it be like to leave that behind, that we can say that I was with my life. I was with whatever arose and passed away. I was with moment after moment experience in my life. I was with the sadness and the joy. I was with my friends and the other people around me. What would it be to leave that kind of legacy? So, may we refine our relationship to time so that we can leave the right kind of legacy for us. Thank you. Questions, comments?
One of the last quotes you read that was similar to Heidegger, would you read it again?
Yeah, the one from Dogen?
Yes.
Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. And I think one of the reasons why he's equated with Heidegger so much is because he's examining what beingness is and connecting that with time and trying to vanquish this notion that time is outside of us. Because when time is outside of us, it's problematic. That's when we get the saving, wasting, spending, taking, and we get a sense of incompleteness. Whereas if we get a sense of it being intertwined within our fabric, then I think a different way of being in the world emerges. Or sensing deeper into beingness itself.
But when you said that every so often they add a millisecond to time or seconds?
Leap seconds. Yeah.
Who is they? And how do
they whoever deals with the atomic clock.
Oh, atomic.
So the atomic clock, that's all. I really don't completely understand it. I know that there's a little bit of imprecision in the clock time that we follow. In terms of that, and they can't even say when they're going to add the leap second. Sometimes they can only give like a year warning or something like that, or a 6 month warning. So that's why there's actually a really big debate about it, because people doing really precise research, it can really mess up their calculations if they get this second that they have to do something about. So then there's argument: should there be leap seconds or not leap seconds? Yeah. Yeah. Uh huh.
Actually, it's a very simple matter. It's the exact same idea as having a leap year. It has to do with the fact that with our notion of a second and the number of days in a year, that says that a year has to be a certain amount of time based on that kind of keeping track of the passage of time. But that doesn't exactly correspond to how long it takes the Earth to move around the sun. Mm-hmm. And so the reason we have leap years is that because there aren't exactly 365 days in a year. And so every so often we add in an extra day so that the calendar will stay in track with the seasons of the year. So, and the leap second is exactly the same thing, it's just on a smaller scale.
So is the reason why they can't give a prediction too far in the future is because our rotation around the sun can vary a little bit? Is that?
That I don't know.
Okay. It does. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of So we just had this really awesome visit by Martine Batchelor last weekend.
Yeah.
And she talked about two things. She talked about creative engagement, and she talked about the Vedanas. And it seems like those are, like, you're the perfect follow-up to those, because it just seems like our relationship with time has a lot to do with how we engage in it, but also sort of the Vedanas or the tonality of our experience makes a lot of difference as well, like whether
yeah.
we're perceiving our experience in terms of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Because neutral can sort of, you know, make us check out and seem like, wow, it's interminable, you know. And
yeah.
I mean, it just seems like, yeah, to interpret it in terms of that is maybe a little bit of a clue to, like, a way to creatively engage with time, and, like, why some things pass really quickly, why some things take forever, and why we're just not aware of part of our experience
yeah.
as time is passing.
Yeah. Because of the flavors, you could say.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah, it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and we're going to either... If it's unpleasant, we might want to just jump to the pleasant or the neutral. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It's kind of the underlying dynamic of how we're pushing and pulling against time. Is that what I'm hearing you saying? Yeah. 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 No, I think you're right. That gives us... I think the nice thing I like about the Vedana is that maybe you experience this with Martine, is that it gives us something really concrete to be aware of. So, because I definitely don't want to propose, oh, we're going to be aware of time. Because nope. that's so vague and unclear, right? But something nice and clear and definite, because then we can also see the dynamic that arises from that, which she must have gone over too. Yeah, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
Well, I got a kick out of reading that when Einstein was trying to explain his theory of relativity to somebody with no scientific knowledge at all, and he said, well, if you're sitting on the sofa with your loved one, time goes by very rapidly. But if you've got your hand on a hot stove, time passes in a totally different manner, which is what I think we're talking about. It's totally relative to our experience, to the passage of what we conceive of as the time.
Yeah, I was trying to really try to divide the kind of the clock time and the watch time from our deep inner sense. I didn't want to talk too much. I talked too much about it, but I didn't want to talk too much about the clock time because I don't understand it.
Well, it's totally a construct.
But we have an inner sense that I feel like can really that informs us in a different way than what's going on in the clock. Yeah. Yeah. Uh huh.
I have two I won't use the word time.
Uh-huh.
Two experiences that I can think of immediately when. Clock time doesn't matter anymore, and I think clock time is kind of, I would say it's an evaluative time, we're always evaluating,
mm-hmm.
but I'm an artist, and when you're in sort of the creative flow, there's no time.
It's a different time. Yeah.
And then I think Thich Nhat Hanh talks about practicing peace, and when I make a decision to do that, to sort of not be busy,
yeah.
and to be more... present, just to, you know, turning the tap on. That also is a different way of being with time.
Yeah.
And it strikes me as being really interesting because the creative flow is you feel like you're merged with whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one went for me when I'm practicing peace,
mm-hmm.
is feeling there's the water. Here I am. There's my hand. That it's not as merged, but it's a very conscious awareness of the elements
yeah.
within.
Nice.
Within
yeah.
Two
yes.
different time.
Yeah.
Two different places where time doesn't seem to get evaluated.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And in some ways we're trying to cultivate, in particular, this witnessing of time, this
mm-hmm.
sensing of time,
mm-hmm.
or sensing of I want to say this witnessing of our experience or the sensing of our experience that gives us a different sense of time. Yeah. 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 And those are examples of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your discourse on time. It's very timely. I just returned from a trip to Europe. And I really noticed at this time in London, these great big massive cities, how people are constrained, rushing back and forth in the subways and just held up for election, and never any time to relax. And I thought, when I was there, I thought, how could you ever practice mindfulness in this situation where you could continually be in just pushed about in this little box, and it seemed like it'd be really hard because people are really intense and just it really posed a dilemma because I was thinking, how could you? I knew I didn't want to exist in that society. However, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, stuff is supposed to be able to exist in all societies, in all times, which you're talking about. And it really creates a paradox. And I noticed in other places, like in Glasgow, where people have more time and they're more relaxed because society wasn't nearly as as grating to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I'm going with that, but I noticed something.
Just a few things about that. It's, we want to cultivate a heart that's ready for anything. And the Buddha was really clear about cultivating an environment and a community that supports practice. And cultivating a rhythm of life that's going to support practice. So I think that's important, is to... He wasn't ignoring that. I mean, he spent most of his time actually creating a community, a monastic community, in order to really develop and cultivate a different rhythm of life that's going to help lead to awakening. So he wasn't saying, just go out there and live wherever you want to do. He was pretty clear about trying to make sure that we have conditions that can help support us. Yeah. Okay, one more.
I've just been thinking about, I have this theme that I'm not ready yet. It seems to be a lifelong theme. And whether it's getting out the door or, you know, I came from an exercise class to come here and I left 10 minutes early and rushed over here, you know, to meditate, being aware that I was rushing as I was coming here. And I don't know what my question is, but it's just really up for me. It's just, you know, very chronic.
Yeah.
And it has to do, I think, somewhat with procrastination and resistance or something.
Yeah. And so what a nice thing might be to do is just to see if you can be with this quality of not being ready yet. What would it be like to kind of sit next to that so that you can kind of hear from that experience more, so you can sense into it a little bit deeper so that you can start to see it clearly? And to see what happens next when you allow space for that. To sit next to it a little bit closer, to really hear from it. Mm-hmm. Really being present with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see what arises from that. Yeah.
Would you mind one question?
Go for it.
As you nicely described, we as humans and as a society have problems dealing with future events or something that's going to be greater or better for ourselves.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, our anticipatory nature and always wanting something to happen and then downfalls with this. But as you alluded to, the notion of putting the past in front of you instead, and this of seeing the past in front of you, and all this in relation to living in the moment. But I was just thinking briefly, are there any pitfalls or any problematic natures with having the past in front of you and maybe living in the past, so to speak? Or I know the problems with having always anticipating things and going to the future, but if you switch it around, is there anything then that could come as well?
It's a good question, and I think probably just as many pitfalls. So I wanted to propose that just to see that our relationship to time is intertwined with our concept of time. And with this practice, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to a non-conceptual experience of moment-to-moment reality so that we're not being bound by concept. So any kind of concept of time is going to be confining, or any kind of concept. So I was just showing, I wanted to give an example of that interrelationship between relating to time and concept. So I don't want to propose that there's some great concept about time out there that we should be following. It's more, can we set aside that and just sense what's going on right now? And the more and more we do that, I think the more and more we start to get a taste on many different levels of freedom. and eventually getting a taste of freedom that really goes beyond time, beyond space, that is timeless, that isn't related to time and space. That's really what the Buddha is pointing us to. It's not just a nice, happy, healthy life. It's an awakened life. It's a life that's awake. And that's touching upon something that goes beyond time and space. That really can happen. I really want to make clear, this is not something that's foreign. This is something that is accessible to all of us.
What happens to impermanence in this mind?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if one of the things we notice is impermanence, that seems to be tied to a different conception of time, not timelessness, but passing time.
Yeah, so I think what happens is the Buddha encourages us to see things arising and passing away. That's one of the characteristics that we see again and again and again. Again and again and again. And once we see phenomena doing that again and again and again, what can happen is then sometimes there's I don't want to use the word experience, because that's really what experience is. Experience has a characteristic, it's marked by impermanence. But sometimes, this is very difficult to describe, but it's as if the mind can take a step back and get a sense of something that is not marked by impermanence. Right? So it's not something that comes and goes. It's not a something. And sometimes it's talking about a stepping back or a profound letting go. A non-experience. Sometimes it's talked about in the terms of non-duality. Sometimes it's talked about in terms of a cessation of experience. So this is what the Buddha is pointing to. It's pointing to awakening, the mind waking up to something going beyond that which is impermanent. Not permanent. That which is beyond impermanence.
Well, that's one view.
Yeah, and I guess I want to make sure that this, I don't want to propose this as a view. It's a sense. It's something, and I think that's why we need to travel the path. It's where does this path unfold to? So it's not a proposition of a view, because any view is still just a view. So I'm just using words, and so of course it's going to be a concept. But I'm trying to give a sense of, yeah, of something more there, or something less. Yeah. And it sounds like it, yeah. I mean, there's been whole Buddhist arguments about this, a view and not view. But I want to be clear, I'm not proposing a different view. I don't want to propose that there's something that is beyond impermanence. It's just the language I have right now. I think we had this conversation before about the unconditioned, didn't we?
Well, perhaps.
Yeah. But, yeah. Thank you very much.